You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Emmy-nominated showrunner and executive producer Deborah Kahn. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Talking to experts in the field, talking to politicians in this country on every end of the political spectrum, and talking to people in other countries, talking to people in the military and journalists and policymakers, I always came away feeling like I had encountered somebody who was really intelligent and had good values and was doing what they were doing because they were trying to make the world better for more people and for people that they didn't know. They didn't necessarily succeed. They didn't necessarily do that with a philosophical set of values that I shared, but I never walked away thinking, that's a bad guy. That's just a bad guy. And that was very much the driving force behind the creation of the show. I feel very fortunate that the medium that I'm in is television, which is a very long form of storytelling. You're not telling a single story, you're telling a world. You're inviting people into a world and asking them to live there with you, with these characters for a period of time. And to me, that's a gratifying thing because I can choose a world that I believe in, build it, and then not take care of it quite so much. When you're telling a singular story, you have a point that you're trying to make. Do you make it by the end of an hour and a half or not? There's a lot of pressure in that, and there's a lot of desire to deliver a single message. Perhaps if there was something philosophical or political or intellectual that you wanted to say. I find that I did all this research. I talked to such incredible people trying to end global conflict. And there are things that they've said that I think, oh my God, I want everybody to know this. I want to make sure the world hears this. And I have a platform and I must say this. Those things never make it in. They absolutely never make it into the story. I build a story around them and then the scene where somebody says that incredibly profound thing gets cut. And I think all that I can expect of people and of myself is that we're trying to do something that is larger than ourselves. The CIA invited a bunch of writers for film and TV to come in and take a tour and learn about the various different capabilities that the CIA is working with, technologies that they're developing, what the work really looks like behind the scenes. And it was just mind-boggling how much knowledge and technological capacity they have and the different kinds of specializations people have. And then at the end of this really 8 hours of touring and talking to different people in different areas, we all had to leave and we had passes that opened the doors and the passes didn't work. So we had been there all day hearing about the great technology and then the special passes couldn't get us out the door. So for 20 minutes, 12 writers sat there watching the most capable and well-meaning people who are fighting for their country every day fail to get the gate to open, you know? So that, to me, is such a perfect moment of what it means to be a power in this world. There are certain ways in which we are an incredibly powerful country. There are certain ways in which our military is mighty and our intelligence services are unparalleled. But then when push comes to shove, you're still dealing with a piece of machinery that half the time doesn't work. Like we are, I think, very much coming up against the limitations of, you know, what the digital technology that we've developed over the last 75 years in this country can do. I have not spent a lot of time playing with ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever they are. I don't want to know if it can write my show better than I can. And it's entirely possible that maybe it can. But I very much am not looking to predict the way world-changing technology is going to unfold on a practical level in our lives. My father was a nuclear engineer. He built nuclear power plants, and he believed that he was creating a form of energy that would save the world, and it did not entirely go that way. But he had a little framed New Yorker cartoon on his desk of an old woman in a rocking chair looking up at a light bulb with like evil little waves coming down from it, like as if the light bulb was going to poison her. And the idea that when the light bulb was first invented, it seemed threatening and it seemed like it would poison us and it seemed like it would be the enemy. I like to think that AI won't be. I think it's amazing to be alive when two of those sort of societal transitions are happening. You know, I lived through the internet's birth and kind of takeover of our lives, and I don't think anybody anticipated that it would become a shopping mall in the way it did. I think that I don't have the imagination and in a lot of ways don't want to have the imagination to try to see where this is going. I think it's very easy to spin out apocalyptic disaster scenarios, and I don't want to live my life that way. I hope it all works out. I hope that the computers don't win to obliterate us completely. But I also hope the planet doesn't burn. I think that we have to do what we can in the time that we're here to make the world safe and viable and meaningful for as many people as we can. And then we have to say, I'm going to pass this along to the next generation and know that they'll do their best. I just want there to be more diplomats in the world. I want people to understand what the tools are, like what are the Legos that they're working with. I don't know who I'm quoting, somebody much wiser than me who said, you know, talking about the military, if the only tool that you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if the only tool that you have is the military, everything looks like a conflict that can only be solved through violence. And I want people to know, what are the steps? What are the moves that we can make diplomatically? What are they doing in those rooms? And what makes a difference and what doesn't make a difference? Simply a greater understanding of those kind of technical logistical pieces hopefully give people a window into how that can go down. People who are doctors, their children are likely to be doctors. And part of that is a shared mission. And part of that is, you know what the day looks like. You know what the work is. It isn't miraculous. It's a series of steps. And I hope that more people can come out with a sense of, oh, I see what they're doing during the day. I see why we think it's a cocktail party and we think it's just a bunch of people getting dressed up and having idle chatter about the weather. What happens at the edges of those conversations about the weather? What happens in the hallway when everybody's having drinks? Like, what solutions can be found in those environments that can really move the needle? I wasn't a political junkie who came to write about politics. I was a drama junkie who wound up on a show that talked about politics. So I had to learn a lot about something that I had no knowledge and experience of. And I think that turned into a skill that I found very useful, to be able to go into a new world and say, so what does it sound like for the people who are really in here? How do they talk to each other? I don't want to have a character explaining something for the audience. I want the audience to believe that they're in this environment, they're really in this world, and that they're hearing how people talk to each other and they're still able to follow as an audience. Also, certainly a large part of what got me where I am is both of my parents are immigrants. My dad is from Germany and he came to New York a year before World War II started. My mom was from Poland and she came a year after World War II ended. She was a hidden child in Poland, and a lot of people risked their lives to take care of her. And I think I very much grew up with the idea that there were the good people and the bad people, and the bad people had tried to kill us, and the good people either were us or were the ones that saved us. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the difference was between those two sets of people. You know, they grew up in the same places, they lived on the same block. Like, why did the neighbors on this side of the house agree to take in and hide this child and the neighbors on the other side of the house didn't? And trying to be honest with myself about which one of those families I would be in that kind of situation. And wanting to not take the out of they were bad and bad people did this. Bad people murdered so many members of my family. I really want to understand the conditions that create that behavior. You know, I wish it was as simple as those people were bad and these people were good, but I don't think it is.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.